With that being said, let's go to 1 Kings chapter 7. I want to do a quick little review. And so I'm going to ask him to put up the first slide here. I know that we had mentioned before, I think that's the second slide. There should be another one. Go to the next one, see what we got there. Yeah, that's not it. The very first one that I gave you. There it is, that one right there. And that, I'm sorry, that's probably my fault of how you said it. I have jet lag, have I mentioned that? So this is the one that I wanted you to kind of look at here, because I mentioned the last time that we were in 1 Kings, which was like 3 weeks ago, that when you go into the temple, when you went into the tabernacle and the temple as we're going through now, everything about it is to remind you of the Garden of Eden, okay? And so notice that that you enter through the east, okay? And because you enter through the east, you then are facing, obviously, the west, okay, as you approach God. So as the priests come in here, they're entering from the east, but they're going towards the west there. So my question is, why did they enter from the east? Why is it so important that the tabernacle faces the east, but it enters, you have to enter from the east? Why is that so important? Well, you have to remember where they came from. Where were they held in captivity? Egypt, okay? And what was it, the main god that Egypt worshipped? The sun god, Ra, okay? That's exactly right. He was considered the king of their gods. He was the one that created everything. He was very powerful, very popular. The most common depiction of the sun god, he wore a sun disc on his head, usually represented by a man with a hawk's body and then a sun disc over his head. And so when the people worshiped Ra, they worshiped towards the east because the sun rises in the east, okay? So being they came from Egypt, as they enter from the east, where are their backs? To the east. And they're now facing towards the west as they come in, and God is in the west. So in order to face God, you have to turn your back on all the other false gods. Okay, that's why it's so important that God, as he was doing this, says, okay, look, we're going to do things completely different than where you came from, okay? The gods of the east, the sun god, which is worship in a multiplicity of societies and things like that, but where they specifically came from, I got to tell you, I'm a different god. In order to come to me, you need to turn your back on all the other gods, okay? So, and I would submit to you, because as you're coming in this way and you're facing God, as you're coming towards God, you're turning your back on the false gods of the east, and specifically the sun god from which you came out of captivity, Egypt. I would submit to you that that as they left the presence of God, the priest and the high priest as he entered in, I would submit to you, even though it doesn't say it anywhere, that they probably backed out. Because you wouldn't want to turn your back on the Holy God, okay? Don't know that, just submitting that to you, it seemed to make sense, okay? And so I just kind of bring that to you to, you know, ponder on your own with that. Now remember, we went over briefly how ornate the temple was. Part of the artistry was the cherubim. So now go back to those other slides that you were showing before. Just so we could get a layout of it. Go back one more. Go back one more. Go back one more. There we go. So that's my fault, by the way, all the way this is, because have I mentioned I'm jet lagged? So again, you can see how this enters in. We're going to talk about Jachin and Boaz, the pillars today, coming in. You see this right here are curtains with doors and folding doors, and you have folding doors here with other curtains, and across the folding doors you have a cherubim and things like that. And then you can see as you go in there how this represents the Garden of Eden, because remember, it's the cherubim that stopped them from going into the Garden of Eden, of going into the presence of God and things like that. So it's the cherubim that blocks your way to God, okay, in a sense. So show the next one, slide. And these are ones that we saw, I was about to say last week, but 3 weeks ago. So you can see how ornate. Everything has date palms on it, cherubims, flowers, budding flowers. Everything is supposed to speak of the Garden of Eden. Okay, go to the next one. And so again, you can see the date palms. You see all the opening flowers there that are budding, and even inside the cherubim, are right there. You see the folding door here that would fold over, to keep them from the holy place, from the Holy of Holies. Okay, go to the next one. And again, just more ornate things that you can see. So, just to give you that understanding of, it's supposed to show the Garden of Eden. And that's where you're trying to get back to. That is the dwelling place of God. That's where God had fellowship with mankind at one time, is in the Garden of Eden. But now there's a barrier. Now the cherubim are there. So those curtains separating the holy place from the Holy of Holies, the cherubim are on there. The Ark of the Covenant is the Holy of Holies, which is where God showed his presence. They're being blocked from his presence because of the cherubim. We're told time and time again that God dwells between the cherubim. We see that in 1 Samuel 4:4. So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. In 2 Samuel 6:2, it says, Judah to bring up from the Ark of God, whose name is called by the name the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. In 2 Kings 19:15, Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, O Lord God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim. It says it again in 1 Chronicles 13:6, that Judah is going to bring up from there the Ark of God, the Lord who dwells between the cherubim. Psalm 80 verse 1, give ear, O shepherd of Israel, you who lead Joseph like a flock, you who dwell between the cherubim, shine forth. And Isaiah 37:16, O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim, you are God, you alone. So these are just a few places where God dwells between the cherubim. Now again, on the curtains, there's cherubim on those curtains. There's cherubim on those doors, those folding doors. And again, it blocks their way to God, who dwells between the cherubim. And this is very crucial because Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So the only way to make it into God's presence is going to be through Jesus. That's the only way that can happen. So when Jesus died on the cross, in Matthew 27, verse 50, it says, and Jesus cried out again with a loud voice, yielded up his spirit. Then behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth quaked and the rocks were split. This veil, this was not a thin bed sheet. At the time, that would have been Herod's temple. And at that point, the veil was massive. It was 60 feet tall, 30 feet wide, 10 inches thick. It was made of 72 braids, each consisting of 24 cords. And it took 300 priests to hang it. That's the one that tore in Herod's temple when Jesus died. And it tore from top to bottom. And again, so it's torn. And so now light is shining in a place that was once dark, where men and women were once excluded, now are all welcome through the sacrifice of what Jesus has done with his blood, that atoning work. And so now you can enter into the presence of the Father through the Son, Jesus, because that's the only way into his presence is through the Son. So when that veil was torn in two, God's Son making the final blood sacrifice for our sins, that makes us available so now we can have fellowship with him. Before it was blocked, now it has been opened through his Son. I am the way, the truth, and life. No one comes to the Father except through me. That's the only conduit. That's the only way you could be brought into the presence of God now. Now also, the veil to the Jew always spoke of the hem of God's garment as well. And when a Jew lost his son, he would tear or rip the hem of his garment to signify that he's had a tremendous loss, and that loss would have been the loss of his son. And so that veil being torn was also testimony that God's son has died. And so God himself was bearing testimony that his son had died. Now, knowing that, let's go back here to 1 Kings. And we're going to go to chapter 6, verse 38, where it says, "And in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month, the house was finished in all its details, and according to all its plans, so was the 7 years in building it." So it took 7 years to build the temple. That's a summary statement. There's still some things that we're going to talk about in the temple that still need to be finished, but it was just a summary statement there. In order to contrast what we're going to read here in verse 1, chapter 7, verse 1 says, "But Solomon took 13 years to build his own house. So he finished all his house." Now, I've read many commentaries that want to contrast that, and as they should, but in a negative way. Why it only takes 7 years, but it took 13 years. And then when you see the footprint of his palace complex, it's bigger than the temple. And does Solomon think that he's better than God? And all these different directions that it goes. But where Scripture is silent, I should probably be silent. And I don't see any negative words in 2 Chronicles or here that says that he shouldn't have built something that was bigger or more elaborate or anything like that. It doesn't say. God says, "I'm going to bless you because you did not ask for riches, but you asked for wisdom. I'm going to give you even more." And so could this not just be part of God's blessing? We could debate that. I would submit to you, according to what he says when he has that vision with God, that this is part of God's blessing. Okay, this is part of God's blessing. And so it says here that in verse 2, he also built the house of the forest of Lebanon. Its length was 100 cubits, its width 50 cubits, its height 30 cubits, 4 rows of cedar pillars and cedar beams on the pillars. And it was paneled with cedar above the beams that were on the 45 pillars, 15 to a row. There were windows with bevel frames in those rows, and windows and window was opposite window in the 3 tiers, and all the doorways and doorposts had rectangular frames, and a window was opposite a window in 3 tiers. And so this palace would be best described as kind of a palace complex. It was called the House of the Forest of Lebanon because of the abundance of cedar that was used there, even more so than what was used in the temple. And so there's so much cedar that adorns this complex that it actually begins to represent or look like the forest of Lebanon. And so that's why it's called the House of the Forest of Lebanon. And so this palace complex measures 100 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, or at least the first part of it does, 30 cubits high, the same height as the temple, even though the first house has a much larger footprint than the temple does itself. And included in this palace complex was the Hall of Pillars. It says he also made the Hall of Pillars. Its length was 50 cubits, its width 30 cubits. In front of them was a portico with pillars, and a canopy was in front of them. We don't really know what this hall is for, but because it has pillars and a canopy and it's open around, it just might be a place for relaxing or reclining, to be outside, to have a breeze go through or whatever. We're not exactly sure what that's for. And then it says in verse 7, "Then he made a hall for the throne, the hall of judgment, where he might judge." So the hall for the throne is called the hall of judgment. I want you to be able to see that. There's not like a hall for the throne and then a hall for the judgment. There, he made a hall for the throne, and it's actually called the hall of judgment, where he might judge. And it was paneled with cedar from floor to ceiling. This is where Solomon would make the judgments on certain cases that would come his way, brought before him. And then in verse 8, it says, "And the house where he dwelt had another court inside the hall of like workmanship." And so there seems to be the high court where Solomon's going to sit and make judgment, and then there seems to be a lower court of some sort that quite possibly there are other judges that would take the smaller cases, the ones that didn't really need Solomon's attention. And so that might be what is being suggested here. There's a higher and lower court. Solomon also made a house like his hall for the Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken as wife. And so Solomon's wife, the daughter to Pharaoh, also gets a house with cedar beams, cedar panels, just like the Hall of Judgment. And yet outside of all these structures is made out of big, very costly stones, it says. And all these were of costly stones cut to size, trimmed with saws inside and out, with foundation to the eaves, also on the outside of the great court. The foundation was of costly stones, large stones, some 10 cubits, some 8 cubits. That would be 15 feet, others 8 feet. So these are very big stones that they're building the walls and the outer structure of. And above the were costly stones, hewn to size, cedar, wood. The great court was enclosed with three rows of hewn stone and rows of cedar beams. So were the inner court of the house of the Lord and the vestibule of the temple. So all these structures of the palace complex were made out of cedar and very big, costly stone. So I'm going to show you, this should be slide 6, I think. We'll see. Hey, all right. I got that one right. So I just want you to, this is obviously an aerial view of someone taking of the Temple Mount area and where all these things can go. And so this is where the Dome of the Rock is today. This is where the temple is supposed to be. So you can see the temple here, and then you can see all the things that Solomon did. Now, if these are to the correct dimensions, or if that, if they're facing the right directions, I don't know from reading here, but this is what this artist kind of put together. So you have right here the House of the Forest of Lebanon. You have next to it here, you have the Hall of Pillars right there. And then over here on the very right, you have the throne room, the higher court. Over here in this area, you have Solomon's house right here. And then you have the lower court right here. And then you have Pharaoh's daughter's house right there. Show the next slide. It shows it in a much more elaborate form up here. So again, whether if it actually looked like that or not, I don't know. You can see the temple. I have no idea what this thing is. It's not nearly that high as we have gone over. And the pillars themselves, Jachin and Boaz, are about the size of the very top of the temple. It goes up a little higher than that, but not that high. So again, just another slide to kind of look at. And, you know, I know this is going to be on the radio, and so anybody can go to this study on our website and be able to see the slides that we're talking about here, and as well as you can. So so you can look at these things. So from there, just to give you kind of a view of what's going on there, let's get back here to the temple in verse 13 of 1 Kings 7. It says, "Now King Solomon sent and brought Huram from Tyre. And he was the son of a widow from the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a bronze worker. He was filled with wisdom and understanding and skill and working with all kinds of bronze work. So he came to King Solomon and did all his work. Huram from Tyre is not to be confused with the king of Tyre named Hiram." Okay, Huram and Hiram. I know it's very confusing, but it's not that guy. All right, Huram has a mother who was Jewish from the tribe of Naphtali, thus showing he qualifies to be working on the temple because he would be of Jewish descent, like Bezalel and Aholiab, who worked and made furniture of the tabernacle. Huram is also divinely skilled in working with bronze. Actually, 2 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 13 tells us he's skilled in more than bronze. It says here that he is also skilled to work in gold, silver, bronze, iron, stone, wood, purple, blue, fine linen, crimson, to make any engraving and to accomplish any plan which may be given to him with your skillful men and with the skillful men of my Lord David, your father. And so this guy is even more skilled than just bronze. He could do just about any trade. He's very, very skilled in that way. Going on here in 1 Kings 7, verse 15, and it says, "And he cast two pillars of bronze, each one 18 cubits high. The line of 12 cubits measured the circumference of each, and then he made two capitals of cast bronze is set on the tops of the pillars. The height of one capital was 5 cubits. The height of the other capital was 5 cubits. He made the lattice network with the wreaths of chain work for the capitals, which were on top of the pillars. 7 chains from one capital, 7 from the other capital. So he made the pillars and the 2 rows of pomegranates above the network all around to cover the capitals that were on the top. And thus he did for the other capital. And the capitals which were on the top of the pillars in the hall were in the shape of lilies, 4 cubits. And the capitals on the 2 pillars also had pomegranates above by the convex surface which was next to the network. Are you getting a picture of it? Or is you just like going, what? For one, what is a convex? I don't know. But it's on the surface, which was next to the network, and there were 200 such pomegranates in a row of each capitals all around. And then he set up the pillars by the vestibule of the temple, and he set up the pillar on the right and called its name Jacob, and he set up the pillar on the left and called its name Boaz. And so the tops of the pillars were in the shape of lilies, so the work of the pillars was finished. Now, each pillar was 18 cubits tall. That means 27 feet. Each capital at the top of the pillar, the capstone, 5 cubits tall. That's another 7.5 feet. And then on top of that, you have on top of the capitals, you have lilies that are 4 cubits. That's another 6 feet. So each pillar with its capstone and lily top was about 40 and a half feet. That's about 4 stories tall. So let's take a look at this slide right here. So you can kind of see it now. There's the capital. There's the lilies right there. Okay. You have Jachin here on the left. You have Boaz here actually coming out. That would be the left, Boaz, and Jachin to the right. And you have a priest down there named Chet. I don't know who he is. So, but this just kind of gives you an idea. Here's the capital, and then there's the lilies that are made of gold that are on top of it. So show the next slide. Because this kind of gives us a better understanding here. So here's the lily work right here. This is the nets. This would be lattice right here. So this is the lattice kind of on the capital right here. Here's the wreath chain work kind of draping down here. Pomegranates down here. And here's the bronze pillar. So all those things that were mentioned, it gives a little bit better kind of an idea of what all that is. Okay. And so... hopefully that helps you there. So I want to take a look at the names of the pillars, okay? Jacob means he shall establish, and then Boaz in his strength or in him is strength. And I find this very fascinating because these pillars seem to be giving a very, very clear message here. These pillars seem to give the message that remember, this is a throne, this is a kingdom established in King David. Solomon's building this, but it is established on David's dynasty, okay? The promise that God gave him. And so this message is that the throne of David is going to be established by God, and we indeed have seen that happen already. And it's going to happen in his strength. So... meaning that God is going to make sure David's throne is going to be established and understand he's the one that is going to do it. Now, if you go over here to 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12, this is what God has promised to David. Here's the Davidic covenant right here. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12, it says, "When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." That would be Solomon. "I will be his father. He shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him as I took him from Saul, who I removed before you." So God's mercy is always going to be mixed, even in the midst of iniquity and disobedience. His mercy is going to be there. Verse 16, "And your house," he's speaking to David, "and your kingdom shall be established forever before you." Is David's kingdom in Jerusalem? is there a seed of David that is on the throne there in Jerusalem? No, it's not. As a matter of fact, it ceased from happening, 2,500 years ago. I think I have that right. Does that sound about right? Yeah, okay. I have jet lag. what that tells me is that that in order for it to happen forever, there has to be a seed that comes back that is of David that will continue forever. So that tells me it's future. Not only does God tell him this here, he also says in Psalm 89, verse 3 and 4, it says, I have made a covenant with my chosen. I have sworn to my servant David, your seed I will establish forever and build up your throne to all generations. He goes on and says in verse 35 and 36 of Psalm 89, once I have sworn to my holiness, I will not lie to David. His seed shall endure forever, and his throne as the sun before me. And so what we're being told is that he's going to have a seed that will finally reign forever, which tells us that that is still future. In 1 Kings 6, verse 11 and 12, as Solomon is building the temple, God kind of, in the midst of the project, tells him, and we went over this last time, that the word of the Lord came to Solomon saying, concerning this temple which you are building, if you walk in my statutes, execute my judgments, keep all my commandments, and walk in them, then I will perform my word with you, which I spoke to your father David, and I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel. Obedience is what was required by each king to have David's blessing, to have his blessing from God. However, to have David's seed upon the throne forever was a promise from God that did not require obedience from David's offspring. His mercy is mixed in with the iniquity and the sin that is going to happen with some of David's future seed in worshiping other gods. And so because of their disobedience, David's kingly line ends. However, God is the one that promised that David's seed would reign forever. And so that means this is still future. And I would submit to you that that's also what Jachin and Boaz means. God has already established this, and he's the one that's going to do it. He's the one that's going to do it by his strength. And we see this as God becoming flesh. God becoming flesh, Jesus, living here, God, man, human, lives a perfect life, then dies for the sin of the world, thus making a way for us into the Father's presence. And now having done this, he has now wrestled away humanity as well as the world from Satan for those who put their trust in him. This is what Revelation 5 is all about. When you all of a sudden, the scroll is there. Who can take the scroll? And John is really bummed out and go, oh, there's no one worthy. There's no. Yes, there is. It's the Lamb slain. That's Jesus. And he takes hold of that. That is the title deed to the earth. It's not until chapter 19 that God says go, and to where he goes and destroys his enemy and sets up his kingdom forever. And he is the seed of David. This is all explained. I can't help but go in this direction knowing that Boaz, well, that's the kinsman redeemer from Ruth. In the book of Ruth, the major players in the book of Ruth are Naomi, Ruth, a guy named Boaz. Naomi, a Jew, had a husband, two sons. When there was a famine in Bethlehem, so they went to Moab. There they lived. Naomi's sons took two wives in Moab. One of these wives is Ruth. So then Ruth is a Gentile, Moabitess. Over time, Naomi's husband died. Then her two sons die, and guess what? They don't have any offspring. And so Ruth is going, I got to go back. you guys might as well go back to Moab. You're still very young. You can have new lives. Don't worry about me, but I got to go back. And one of them does, but Ruth says, no, I love you. I'm part of this family, and I will return with you to Bethlehem. And so she does. Naomi is still very poor. Even though she can return to her house, her land is not hers anymore. Before they went to Moab, Naomi and her husband must have sold off their land because of the famine in the land. And see, today if you sell property, it belongs to someone else. Not so in Jewish and Israel culture from what God has laid down, that when you sold your property, it's more like a lease. You only have it until that person can buy it back. In Leviticus 25, it states this. It says, the land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, God says. For you are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the land of your possession you shall grant redemption of the land. If one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and if his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother sold. Or if the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself becomes able to redeem it, then let him count the years since its sale, restore the remainder to the man to whom he sold it, that he may return to his possession. And that's Leviticus chapter 25, verses 23 through 27. The purpose of this law was to protect property rights of the families and the different tribes of Israel. God owned the land, didn't want it exploited by rich people who would take advantage of poor people and widows. And when obeyed, this made sure that a dead man's family's name did not die with him and that his property was not sold outside the tribe. The word redeem here means to set free by paying a price. So in Israel, when someone sold a piece of property, it's really a lease. And you purchase the use of the ground. There is always a provision for you to be able to buy it back, or a family member or a kinsman or family member being able to buy it back for you. That was always there. So Naomi and Ruth, they're now back in Bethlehem. They have no land to grow anything or in an order to provide for themselves. So being poor, they indulge in a practice called gleaning. And what gleaning is if you own a field and you harvested that field, you were only allowed to pass through that field once. Gleaning as you go. You're only able to allow to pass through it once to harvest it. Whatever you missed or fell to the ground was supposed to be left behind for widows and orphans and those who were down and out. And they would gather behind the reapers, and whatever the reapers had missed, that's what they would take. This is their idea of a welfare program, and I could go off on that all day of how wise that is, and wasn't just given to them. There was still some work that they had to do, but something, it's a hand up, it's not a hand out, you know. And so Ruth does this on behalf of herself and Naomi, and she's younger, she can be out in the field all day, and Naomi's a lot older, and she can't. And so that's what Ruth does, and she comes upon and happens upon the field of Boaz. Boaz sees Ruth, she pleases him. Boaz is a little twittipated himself. He sees her and his heart starts to thump a little bit, and he instructs his men not to bother her, make sure she's okay, even to drop a little extra for her. Okay. Ruth goes home. Naomi's really surprised of how much she has, and she asks, where were you gleaning today? And she says, in a field that is owned by Boaz. A light goes off in her head as she realizes that Boaz is a relative, a family member, a kinsman. So Boaz is wealthy, a relative of Naomi, and she realizes that the reason she has so much is because Boaz has taken a fancy to her. That's right, I said the word fancy. I never thought I'd do that today, but I have jet lag. So I want you to go to chapter 3 of Ruth. I want you to read what kind of happens here after setting up all that I just read to you, or explained to you, I should say. Here in verse 1 of chapter 3 of Ruth, it says, then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? Now, Boaz, whose young woman you are with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Now, the threshing floor is at the time of harvest, is that you would take the grain and you would go up on a hill and that a breeze was coming by, and you would take the grain and you would throw it up, and the wind would blow the chaff, but the actual kernels would fall to the ground. And so that would be the grain that was worth something. And so they would make a huge pile of grain there. You would sleep there. So no one would steal your grain. This is a time when there'd be celebration of drinking and eating and with the workers. And again, they would sleep out there to make sure that no one would steal the grain. So it goes on and it says, therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself, put on your best garment, go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies. You should go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. Basically, what she's telling him to do is that he's going to have a good old time. He's going to be drinking, and then all of a sudden, he's just going to fall off to sleep right there on his grain. And so when he does that, uncover his feet and lie down. And she said to her, all that you say to me, I will do. So she went down to the threshing floor, did according to all her mother-in-law instructed her. And after Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. She came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Now it happened at midnight that the man was startled, turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, who are you? So she answered, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, and you are a close relative. So what she is saying here is that this is how you are going to present yourself, is that once he's asleep, the hem of the garment, which is the wing of his cloak there, is a symbol of authority, and Ruth is asking, by doing that, Ruth is asking Boaz to be her kinsman, to redeem her, to protect her. And even though Naomi is a Jew and is a kinsman to Boaz, Ruth is his kinsman too by marriage because she married one of Naomi's sons. And so because the sons died and there was no offspring to raise up, then she is also now Naomi's daughter. And so she needs to be married in order to produce offspring for the family. And so she is now part of the family. And if someone marries Ruth, it would have to be a relative that would help her carry on the family name so the family would not die off. And so what Ruth is asking Boaz is to be her kinsman, is to be that family member and that she could be his wife to raise up a seed, a son, so she can carry on the family name. And so Boaz, as we're going to see here, is very flattered because he's much older, and yet she is very beautiful. And so it says here in verse 10, then he said, blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, and that you did not go after young men, whether rich, poor, or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. She has a very good reputation. Now, it is true that I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that he will perform the duty of a close relative for you. Good, let him do it. But if he does not want to perform the duty for you, I will perform the duty for you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning. So she lay at her feet until morning, and she rose before one could recognize another. Then he said, do not let it be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. So there is a nearer kinsman, and so he has to have the opportunity to say yay or nay first. So Boaz goes to the other kinsman and says to Naomi, your kinsman, her land needs to be redeemed. The other kinsman says, okay, I'll do that. But then Boaz continues to say, you'll have to marry her daughter, daughter-in-law, Ruth, to raise up seed for the family name. And at this, he declines because he already has a wife. He already has offspring. Once he marries her, now his property and fortune now has to be divided up with her and her offspring. And so his wife and his offspring aren't going to like that. Okay? Aren't going to like that. So once he finds out there's a woman involved, he goes, no, don't want anything to do with that. So what happens? Boaz marries her. Boaz redeems her. And so he marries Ruth and redeems the land back to Naomi. Now, the picture here is the best picture. I love the book of Ruth. I love going through Revelation chapter 5, where we go over the book of Ruth to really understand what a kinsman redeemer is, the Goel. It's a near relative of the same family, of the same tribe. And he must be able to fulfill the obligation of a kinsman redeemer. It's interesting that the picture here, you have Boaz, who takes a Gentile bride, Ruth, redeems her, but he also redeems the land for Naomi. Interesting, because Boaz is a type of in his strength, is a type of Jesus Christ. Ruth is a type of the church, because she's a Gentile bride. And then you have Naomi as a type of Israel, the Jews. It's interesting here that Naomi, a Jew, is one that points the way to Boaz for Ruth. And yet it's also Ruth who reveals to Boaz to Naomi. Think about that. Think about that for a moment. Because the Jews have rejected their Messiah, the Messiah comes to us, the Gentiles. And also because the Messiah is working with the universal church, the Gentiles, it's going to provoke the Jews to jealousy, to where we then reintroduce the Jews to their Messiah. As the Jews basically force the Messiah on us, given it the Messiah, we in turn reintroduce the Messiah back to the Jews. In Romans chapter 10, I want you to go there. Go to Romans chapter 10. Starting in verse 14, it says, "How then shall they call on him in whom they've not believed? How shall they believe in him whom they've not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they preach unless they're sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace, who bring glad tidings of good things. For they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, 'Lord, who has believed our report?' So then faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. But I say, have they not heard? Yes, indeed. Their sound has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. But I say, did Israel not know? Yes, they did. First Moses says, 'I will provoke you to jealousy by those who are not a nation, and I'll move you to anger by a foolish nation.' But Isaiah is very bold and says, 'I was found by those who did not seek me.' Those are the Gentiles. And I was made manifest to those who did not ask for me. But to Israel, he says, 'All day long I have stretched out my hands to a disobedient and contrary people.'" So because of the rejection of the gospel, and that the gospel came to us, it is through that blessing that God is going to, is what he's doing with the church, that will be that we will be able to point a lot of the Jews back to their Messiah during the church age. Now, this kinsman redeemer, again, had to meet three requirements. Had to be a near kinsman, blood relative. Had to be able to pay the price. And it had to be the exact price of redemption. Only Jesus fits these qualifications. And is it any wonder why God had to become flesh? Because the only way to redeem mankind, if you had to redeem humanity, you had to be human. Thus, God becoming flesh. John 1:14, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory. The glory is the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. This is why God had to become man, because humanity had to have a kinsman, a relative, a family member of the human race, who could purchase back that which was lost. That's why God had to become man. Galatians 4:4, "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law." Philippians 2:5, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God did not consider robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in the appearance as a man, he humbled himself, became obedient to the point of death, because that's what was required. Wages of sin is death. Jesus is our blood relative, our kinsman redeemer, because he became man. God becoming man, the incarnation. The kinsman redeemer had the duty of buying the family members out of slavery in Leviticus 25:47-50. Jesus redeems us from slavery of sin and death. Romans 6:17, but God be thanked through you that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. Jesus, very willing to pay the price, Matthew 20:28, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many, the redemption for many. John 10:11 says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. John 10:17, therefore my Father loves me because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down. I have power to take it again. The command I have received from my Father. Jesus is the only one that could pay the price. He had the exact payment that was needed for redemption, a perfect life. 2 Corinthians 5:21, for he made him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that we might become the righteous of God in him. 1 Peter 1:18-19, knowing that you are not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from the aimless conduct received by tradition from their fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ as a lamb without blemish and without spot. These pillars that we're looking at, Jachin and Boaz, not only speaks of the establishment of that promise that God gave to David with his kingdom, but it also speaks of that God is the one that is going to fulfill that promise in the future. He's the one that's going to fulfill that prophecy. And he already started to do that by sending down his Son to say that God became man in order to pay and be that kinsman redeemer, that price for humanity. And so now we read in Revelation chapter 5 that he's the one that takes the scroll. And then at that point, he just waits until God says go, and we read about that in Revelation chapter 19 at the second coming. And so I would submit to you that these pillars give testimony of this. Amen.